Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Paul Williams, and we are going to be talking about The City and the City by China Mieville, which was the co-winner of the 2010 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So thanks for joining me, Paul.
Good to be here. Very excited.
It's good to have you. So let's talk a little bit about you. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah. So I am not a podcaster of any sort or anything like that, but I'm a PhD student at Idaho State University. I'm writing my dissertation. I specialize in late 20th and early 21st century literature, but really my real specialty is actually fantasy, science fiction, and I'm doing my dissertation on alternate history, actually.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, I was looking for something to listen to when I went for a walk and typed in, I looked for Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell in the podcast app, and that you popped up, and I've listened to you intermittently. And then earlier when in COVID, I started listening a lot.
So nice. And this is another contact form success story where you're like, hey, just go up and fire off an email.
It's true.
So, one thing that you had talked about in our correspondence before we did the podcast was that we kind of approach science fiction and fantasy from opposite ends of the spectrum.
It's true.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So you've talked a lot in many of your episodes about how you often on the fantasy episodes, you'll say things like, I favor science fiction, fantasy, not really my thing. And I'm very much the opposite. Like I read many fantasy books a year and a couple sci-fi here and there. And usually a sci-fi has to really be hyped up for me to tackle it. And so it's just, we are like complete polar opposites in that particular respect. I think we're the same amounts in different directions.
Okay. Nice. Yin and yang, the city and the city, right?
Yes.
I mean, that works perfectly.
Yes. The host and the host.
Right. Yes. I try to unsee fantasy whenever I can.
Oh, fair enough.
I'm just joking. Fair enough. So, I mean, what is your story with becoming a science fiction and fantasy fan? Is there a particular media or books?
Yeah, actually. I mean, I've just always been into fantasy without realizing it. So let's see. I grew up in a house. Star Wars was a thing for us. I remember when the THX box set of the trilogy came out in the mid 90s. And my mom bought those, and that was like the coolest thing that we ever had. Star Wars. My mom was a big Star Trek fan, but I was really resistant to reading. I refused to read until I got into the Animorphs books in fourth grade. I actually started out in science fiction, but then I found out about this thing called The Hobbit. And maybe it's my religious background. I don't know, but I was really I find that my religiosity and fantasy link up really well in that respect. And so I've often been more into fantasy. The big one for me was Ursula Le Guin's A Wizard of Earthsea. That was the big book in my life in that respect. And then in my adulthood, it's been just more and more. Started out with Sanderson, but then I've been getting like John Crowley, Gene Wolfe, people like that. Sophia Samatar, I finished her book last night. And it's just been this ever-growing thing. And then I found, I was teaching high school up in Rexburg, Idaho, and found out that one of the pioneers of fantasy literature scholarship was at Idaho State in Pocatello. So I applied and came down here.
Nice. Did you happen to tally up your Hugo count, by the way?
I did. So I found out that I've read 15 of the Hugo novel winners. It does get a bit... It gets a bit bigger if we expand it to graphic novels. I get to add 3 of those and a few short stories and novellas I could add as well. But 15 of the novels that I've read.
Well, I was going to say, because I told you over email, I've kind of stopped asking that question because I started off only having read 12 of them, and I thought it was interesting to see, when everybody had read more than I had. And now that I'm into, I don't even know what it is. It's like 60 or 59.
Yeah.
It feels like bragging now. And, but I think with you talking about coming at things from opposite perspectives about fantasy and science fiction, there's a lot more science fiction on the Hugo winners than there is fantasy.
Yeah. I was thinking about that when I was counting that up. I was like, wow. I mean, 2000 is the first pure fantasy novel win with Goblet, 2001 with Goblet of Fire. The only other one before that potentially is Lord of Light, which I haven't read, but my thesis advisor wrote about it in his dissertation about Lord of Light as science fantasy and trying to argue that one. So Yeah.
Nice. So I just looked. My number is 61.
Oh,
wow. Just for the record.
Good on you, sir.
Yeah. So, yeah, closing in.
Yeah, no. And frankly, you make me want to read more Hugo winners. And so I was looking at it, my bookshelf earlier today, and like, I've read a handful of Hugo winners, like more than I've usually read it in a year this year. And the next few books I want to read, hopefully during the holidays, would be include Hyperion and A Memory Called Empire.
Oh, nice.
Which are both Hugo winners. And maybe then I'll jump into, I'll finish the Broken Earth trilogy. I don't know. So.
Mm-hmm. Nice. There's also the other Lois McMaster Bujold winner, the
Paladin
of Souls. That's one of her, that's one of her fantasy series.
That one was going to be my next choice if we didn't do City in the City.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and pivot to talking about the actual book here.
Yeah.
Because is this a fantasy book? I mean, I guess I should ask why this book.
Yeah. Yeah. So I chose this one because I've wanted to read Mieville for a while. And, and this is one that I like the fact because it won both the World Fantasy Award and the Arthur C. Clarke Award. And it's like, how do you do that? How do you win the top fantasy award and the top science fiction award? That's peculiar to me. My favorite type of literature after fantasy is Russian literature. And this telegraphs some Russianisms, Slavicisms, whatever you call them. And I was just really intrigued by that question about, cause it's, is it really either, honestly, is a good question.
Right.
And maybe that'll be something to talk about more. So when we get into the spoiler section, whether or not it's definitely a genre novel, but wow.
Yeah. I think he puts it into weird fiction.
Yes.
Like if you ask him what this novel is, he's like, it's weird fiction detective novel.
Yeah. I mean, I think really I do think, you know, book blurbs can be a upper, you know, give or take. But really, I think I'm sure you probably read the Kindle, I'm going to guess, or that's what you usually do. Or did you get the paperback?
Nook, actually.
Oh, yeah. So the
Barnes & Noble Nook.
On the paperback, it has this blurb. It says, if Philip K. Dick and Raymond Chandler's love child were raised by Franz Kafka, the writing that emerged might resemble The City in the City. And wow, is that one of the most accurate book blurbs I've ever read in my life. One of the last classes I took for my coursework before I moved on to dissertation work was a class on detective fiction and setting. And last week I saw with the professor from that class, I was like, Hal, there's a book that it's criminal we didn't include it in the syllabus. I told him about The City in the City because it's all about detective work in setting. It's very much about those things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
That sounds like a good jumping off point for a brief kind of non-spoiler summary of this book. I don't know how you can get non-spoiler.
Watch this,
because all right.
So I actually wrote this out. I said, a woman is found dead near a skate park in the rundown city of Beschel in an undetermined Eastern European country. As Inspector Theodore Borloo investigates, he quickly starts to detect a connection between this murder and the far more wealthy and modern neighbor city, Olkoma. The problem is that the cities of Beschel and Olkoma actually occupy the same geographical space, but the citizens of both cities are trained from birth to unsee each other, the violation of which is a taboo of the highest order. Borloo must navigate a century of cultural training, civic prejudices, and complex bureaucracy to solve this case and bring the women's killers to justice.
Nice. All right. Well done.
Yeah. I know lots of people, some people apparently make a big deal about the unseeing and seeing element as a spoiler. Like, really, that's, you get that in the first chapter. So I don't really feel bad about that.
You do, but I do like, and let's go ahead and move into kind of overall thoughts about this.
Yeah.
And one thing that I really like about this is that he drops you right into it.
He does.
He does not hold your hand. And right at the kind of toward the end of the first chapter, you see him see somebody and he says something like, you know, he's is not supposed to see her. And he talks about unseeing and he drops this terminology on you. And then you just have to kind of learn it from the rest of the book. And I really like that. I thought that was pretty skillfully done.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I already knew that particular aspect of the novel. Just from having read a couple of reviews about it a while ago. It's the kind of novel like where I spent the first maybe 100 pages, I was moving super slow, annotating the crap out of this thing. And then, as on the one hand, there's a lot of like uncertainty. It's like, does that mean something? I don't know if that means something or not. And then, but then after about 100 pages, it's like, no, like you realize how skillfully he has introduced you to this world without ever just info dumping on you. and you just go. It just takes off. Once you get to Olcoma, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll say I got through this one really, really quickly for me, because I don't usually read super quickly. And I think the thing that helped me with this one is one of my favorite genres of television is detective, and especially British detective fiction. So we like stuff like Broadchurch and Luther and Line of Duty and Scott and Bailey and all these other shows. And so this one very strongly felt like that.
Okay.
I haven't read a lot of like Raymond Chandler and other like noir kind of stuff, but you can definitely see that DNA in the book. And then we'll talk about the television series at some point. They lean right into that, complete with the voiceover and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, really?
But so it's interesting because there's the interesting world building. And this is a problem that I have with fantasy literature sometimes, is I feel like you can end up with world building that kind of detracts from the story, where it's like, okay, we're going to introduce some interesting stuff, and then we're going to go on a 25-page junket over and talk about the topography of this valley. And like, I don't care about that. But when it's about like society and something interesting like this, where it's parallel cities that occupy the same space, it's just, I mean, it's weird. I mean, weird fiction, right? And that makes it pretty compelling to me. I'm not sure, like when I think about overall thoughts about this one, I liked it. I definitely liked it. I don't think I loved it. I think I felt like the world building part of it was more interesting than the actual detective story. The detective story just felt like sort of typical fare. So I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I did feel that, I felt that the setting was the strongest part of the novel, definitely. It's actually kind of funny. So just before I read this, I read a novel for my dissertation, A Dead Jinn in Cairo by P. Jolly Clark, that just came out. And it's also a detective fiction. Mm. I had no plans of having two detective novels in a row. That one was super strong as an alternate history, but kind of weak as a mystery novel. I felt that was easily the weakest part of that one. So this one was much stronger in comparison to that one, but it moves so fast, and it moves fast with things that we aren't familiar with. Like a lot of critics would talk about how genre fictions have to really pay attention to the things that the audience would already know about. So things are, this is the familiarity that we're familiar with. That's a terrible word, a terrible phrasing, but the familiar becomes, when you're writing a dissertation, you get very self-conscious about your sentences, but you also have some really weird tautologies. But anyways, a lot of it is the rhetorical delivery of things. And so if you lean into what the audience is familiar with, and then you can then trade very heavily on the genre aspects. And detective fiction, science fiction, fantasy, they all do these in different ways and different amounts. And so I found that this one, first of all, it's staggering that he's able to actually balance as well as he does between things. But that being said, it's also very clear that he is more interested, I think, in the ideas that underpin this. And I don't know if that's entirely the book's detriment. I think it will have powerful impacts on the reading experience with this. And kind of building off of that, I think, I like detective TV. Like Broadchurch, I think that's one of the few shows I just sat down on a Saturday and just binged right through during grad school.
Oh yeah. It's fantastic.
It's so good. But I don't watch a lot of it, but I did notice, at least to me, I felt that this book was very kind of, was actually really subversive of the detective story in many ways. I don't know if you picked up on this or if you felt this way as well, but for instance, I just was intrigued as like, often detective fiction, it covers a week or a weekend. I find like The Big Sleep covers a weekend, for instance.
Sure.
This one, it's like, there are time skips. It's like, yeah, you know, we sat down, we had this meeting 2 days later, and like that just doesn't happen in detective storytelling normally. And I thought that was really interesting how those conventions are toyed with throughout the novel. And I feel like I wonder how much of that sense of the detective story being weaker in this novel is more so just the fact that it's so different and mundane.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, you know, the calling the detective story weaker is probably not fair.
That's good.
Really, I think what I would say is like, if I had lingering questions about stuff in this book, it wasn't the detective part.
Gotcha.
That part I felt like it was wrapped up with a pretty neat bow.
Gotcha.
It made sense. It wasn't the kind of story that kind of keeps you guessing.
Yeah.
because it wasn't a whodunit, right? You didn't really have, could it be this person? Could it be that person? Like Broadchurch does, where in every episode, it's pointing you at a different person and kind of keeping the misdirection in place so you can't figure out who it is.
Yeah.
This doesn't have that. And so the questions that I have are like, okay, they talk about the cleaving of the two cities. Did that mean they were being ripped apart or put together? Because that word is flexible.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And there's all kinds of other questions about the world that he built here that I would like to know that aren't answered in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you there. I was shocked that we don't get background about the cleaving. And you know, like for me, the question was, why are these characters so invested in the separation? That was the thing I found most interesting is like whenever there was a moral dilemma about the cities, it was very hard to understand why does that matter? And yet the characters treated it with so much gravity that like, you know what? It must be important. Okay.
Right. It just is.
Yeah. Or, you know, I think maybe Mieville also wants us to keep in mind that these are, that human systems work on such a huge level that you can't fix them on the immediate level. And so a detective adventure is not going to be able to fix this. And I think in some ways that he's trying to steer us towards that point, but it can be very frustrating in terms of a detective story. Cool. And then at the end it's like, but what?
Yeah, pretty much. I will say, I feel like the world building alone here for me completely justifies the Hugo win.
Yeah.
And that's as someone who is not a big fan of world building. So if it works, it really works. And I like it.
Yeah. It's this very surrealist Kafka-esque thing. It's the most Philip K. Dick novel, not by Philip K. Dick, I've ever read.
We should get over into spoilers at some point. I think it makes sense to talk about like in general terms about this book for a while, because it is kind of a mood thing almost. But I do want to, I was trying to figure out if I could come up with any comps for the book and detective fiction. Sure. But I didn't come up with anything else.
Okay. So I actually have quite the list for you. So, So I already mentioned A Master of Gin by P. J. L. E. Clarke. Again, has some flaws, but that was a really, like, if that's the weakest book in my dissertation, it's gonna be a really good dissertation. For another urban fantasy story would be The Craft Sequence by Max Gladstone. It's my favorite urban fantasy that I've read, and Max is a great guy. I've met him, he's a cool guy. So this is what, if this is a fantasy novel, if we read it as a fantasy novel, it's what Farah Mendelson calls a liminal fantasy. If her book Rhetorics of Fantasy had come out 2 years later, this would be the book she would talk about in that chapter. It came out too late, so she doesn't, but it would have. So liminal fantasies are where the fantastical, the supernatural, the surreal things are out in the corner of your eye, and it's these kind of worlds kind of crouching on each other. So I have to give a shout out to John Crowley's Little Big, which is still the most beautifully written novel I've ever read in my life. You, Seth, would find it boring as could possibly be, but it is beautiful. It's a postmodern fairy tale. It's absolutely wonderful. Everyone but Seth should read it.
I have to say, I do think it's interesting how well my listeners can get to know me through the podcast.
Yeah. Galveston by Sean Stewart is really good. Umbria in Shadow by Patricia McKillop. Lud in the Mist by Hope Merlies. That's a classic fantasy from 1926. So it's always interesting if you can read a pre-Tolkien fantasy. It's always really cool. That's Lud in the Mist. And the short stories of Jorge Luis Borges. This novel is very Borgesian. Orsinian Tales by Ursula Le Guin, which is set in a fictional Eastern European country. And I do feel that Orsini, that will come up, we'll talk about that later in the spoiler section, might be somewhat a send up to Orsinia, maybe.
Yeah.
The Dispossessed by Le Guin has some similar questions. Ted Chiang's short fiction kind of reminded me of this. And if you want something that's just mind-bending and tricky as all get out, Gene Wolfe, holy crap. And I know that Mieville is a big admirer of Wolfe. Incredibly difficult author, but one that I find rewarding. But he requires, reading Gene Wolfe is an act of faith, so that it will pay off eventually.
Nice.
So there's a few.
All right, good list.
Oh, and The Adjustment Bureau for a film. by
yeah, actually that because of Breach. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Every
that was something that I was going to write down and I never did. Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and go right over into spoilers from here? We've been talking about it long enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, it sounded like, I guess I didn't hear it. It's a recommend from you.
Yeah? Yes. I would recommend this one, just maybe not to the people I would normally recommend it to, I think.
Okay. Nice. All right. So spoiler time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to bounce off that thing with the Adjustment Bureau, because I think this lends to more talk about what the genre of this novel is and what the combination of the cities actually is, because I think it's possible to read it in a purely physical sense, right? That the cities are, it uses the terms crosshatched, right?
Yes.
So that means on a particular street, you might have a house that's in Bejel and a house that's in Okoma.
Yeah.
And they're right next to each other. You know, it's, but like the doors are facing opposite directions or something. And you, of course you can't, you can't knock on that wall and talk to the person on the other side.
Yeah.
Cause that's not okay. But like, I was trying to think, and the book, sorry, I'm a little scattered on this.
You're fine.
The book lends itself to that interpretation that it's purely physical and then like mental conditioning that everybody does. But then all of a sudden Breach shows up. Just apparently they step out of doorways, you know, wearing their fedoras like in the Adjustment Bureau.
Yeah.
And they're just there. And I'm like, where were they? And the series I think does a pretty good job with this.
Oh, really?
But yeah, like they just sort of teleported in, it seemed like.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, not in the series. I'm talking about in the book. It's just like they just appear there.
And well, and that gets into, I mean, you can still take that very materialist approach, right? It's the idea that it's just there are these physical spaces that we just completely avoid entirely. And again, that's a bit harder to justify the material level, but like you can still kind of take in that more material, slightly surreal take. But yeah, Breach really does complicate that reading, I think. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But is it like, is space folding or what? Are they in pocket dimensions or?
Originally, when I started reading this, what I was picturing was Counterpart. I don't know if you've ever seen that series. Where, you know, in Berlin, there's essentially, you can go down to the basement of this building and cross over into a parallel Berlin.
Okay.
And that's sort of what I pictured with, what's it called? Copula Hall.
Yeah.
So I kind of pictured some of that, and that made it seem like a parallel dimension sort of thing. But in a parallel dimension, you shouldn't be able to breach and actually see
right?
Where they could, if they don't unsee things, then they commit breach.
Yeah. But it is interesting how he does a really good job creating the sense of like, as if you are on like, just like the next dimension over, right? And so the dimensions are mostly overlapping, but there's a slight, I don't know, it's like, you know, put a blue filter over the camera, right? Or something like that when you're in Bechel.
Right, right. Yeah, put on your 3D glasses.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was so interesting. And I would suspect that, well, I mean, he calls out the Berlin's Jerusalem and a few other places as where he definitely gets the idea for this kind of storytelling. He just takes it to a very cerebral extension or extreme.
Yeah.
I do think, that's been one of the most difficult questions for me as well. Like, I mean, I in my case, I usually do kind of, if I have a more fantastical or science fictional explanation, I generally lean into that because those are more fun. But but he does, he so thoroughly wants you to think of this as a sociological effect, and that is, I think, really important to how this novel works.
Yeah. Now you're a bit younger than I am, right? So you probably don't even remember East and West Germany, right?
The Berlin Wall fell when I was still in diapers.
Okay. So I was in high school and actually studying German, and my teacher was from East Berlin, and she was, we came into school that day, and she was just a basket case.
Oh wow!
Dang.
Yeah. I mean, my best friend has a PhD in Russian, so I do know a little bit about that time, but.
Yeah,
not quite the same as yours.
I mean, there's something that, you know, I've seen in other reviews of the book that talk about the whole unseeing thing and like maybe a negative critique of our society where we tend to unsee things we don't want to see.
Yeah.
And you can see that in, you know, privilege of various kinds. You can see in the, you know, driving through an area with a homeless camp, you know, and just like averting your eyes, or the panhandler on the freeway overpass, right?
Yeah.
You just like give them the look ahead. And that's like unseeing.
Yeah. I was reminded often about a video essay I saw years ago, this guy talking about, because I grew up in the DC area, and he was talking about DC and how we film DC as you know, as a great, glorious capital. But he makes a point, because he's from that area as well, this video reviewer, and he talks about how he shows this video clip of there's like tons of homelessness just a few blocks from the White House. And how we just kind of strategically push these things out of our view and out of our thoughts in that way. Which that actually kind of, I'm trying to find my notes really fast. Where is, let me see if I can pull this up really fast in the book.
That kind of reminds me of the movie Widows.
Never seen it.
Steve McQueen movie. And at some point there's a Colin Farrell is playing a politician who is, you know, canvassing on the kind of the other side of the city from where he is in housing projects and more less affluent areas. And at some point they're driving back from there, and the camera is kind of on the front of the car, and it shows them leaving the kind of unfamiliar and ending up back in his swanky neighborhood. And it's a really, really interesting technique in that movie to show you that this guy is not from that world.
Interesting.
And he's dipping his toes in it for political advantage.
Okay. Yeah. So, this is on page 44 and 45 in the paperback. It says, as the river industry of Bechel had slowed, Olcoma's business picked up, and now there were more foreigners walking on the worn down crosshatched cobbles than Bechel locals. The once collapsing Olcoma rookeries, crenellated and lumpen baroque, not that I saw them, I unsaw carefully, but they still registered a little illicitly, and I remembered the styles from photographs, were renovated, the size of galleries, and the UCK startups. I watched the local buildings' numbers. They rose in stutters, interspersed with foreign altar spaces. In Bechel, the area was pretty unpeopled, but not elsewhere across the border, and I had to unseeing dodge many smart young businessmen and women. Their voices were muted to me, random noises. The aural fade comes from years of Bech care. And when I read that, the thought I had was, I feel like Bechel and Olcoma are not stable entities, that basically Bechel is the old worn down places of Olcoma that kind of transition to Bechel. And then when places in Bechel get too old and decrepit and get condemned and then bought up and renovated, those turn into Olcoma.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that idea.
Yeah. Cause so I don't
that,
know if you're-
that also reminds me of my, my sister, when she graduated high school, she graduated high school a few years before I did. And she did, a trip with this organization called People to People.
Okay.
And she got to go to Europe, and she got to go to Eastern Europe. And so they went to Berlin. They went to West Berlin and East Berlin. And she said it was really interesting when you went from West Berlin to East Berlin, because all of a sudden in East Berlin, everything was dirty.
Yeah.
In West Berlin, everything was shiny.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I see in the Olcoma and Bechel.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if you are aware of this. So Mieville actually has a PhD in poli-sci. From the London School of Economics. Mm-hmm. And he's just a very, very, very politically minded and a very left-leaning thinker in that respect. And so I think that any sort of economic reading you can push into this story, I think Mieville would be happy and would agree with, most likely.
Right.
And so that's kind of why I came with that idea that it's really as the city is evolving and changing. And so maybe at one point in time, there was a very clear delineation between the two cities, but as one person keeps their house up really nice, and the other person lets their house go to crap, and then that starts to create the cross hatching happens then.
Right.
Because I think they said it's been
literally flipping houses from one city into the other.
Yeah, there you go. Because they've had a century to be doing this, right? So, yeah.
I mean, some of it also reminds me of like the fact that you have the rest of the world just going on their normal business, but understanding that here there are these two cities that have this unique relationship to each other. You can draw like a North Korea, South Korea thing there too, right? Where like we just don't think about North Korea unless they're doing something, and people there are suffering, right? And I was talking to my son one time, and I'm like, I don't know why we let North Korea exist. Because we know that the people who live there are suffering and being oppressed and being gaslighted, you know, to say that no, anything that you're suffering, it's not because we're taking all the good stuff. It's because the United States is doing bad stuff. Not that we aren't doing bad stuff, but
yeah,
it's just one of those things.
Yeah, the political, the real world applications of the novel, I think, are very powerful. And that's, in some ways, I'm kind of surprised that this novel won a Hugo, because, like, you would think it would alienate a huge audience by being so relevant in that respect. It's kind of surprising that it did win in that respect. I mean, very good book, and we already said very much winning, deserving of its win, but just more than anything, surprising that it won.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have any other thoughts about, like, the makeup of the cities in that respect?
No, not really. I think we've kind of already talked about the, like, the, if it's literal or non-literal, or if it's some fantasy thing as well. Because then when you bring in the whole Orsini thing, then I have to admit, when I was reading the book, I thought, okay, all these rumors about Orsini, Breach is Orsini.
Yeah.
You know, and they're, and somehow they are propping up the notion that there could be this third city out there so people don't look at them. But
yeah,
it didn't pan out that way.
No, it did not.
As far as I can tell.
Yeah. No, and I agree. That was really surprising how that was the case. And again, I wonder if that's just Mieville is trying to steer us away from the idea of there is no one to blame, right? That there's no bad guys, so much to say. Right. Rather, there's no boogeyman in our world, and we need to actually confront our issues rather than the scapegoats. Mm-hmm. I think that might be a big part of what he's doing there. And then I think it's part of what's so frustrating is it's weird to have a genre novel that pivots you continuously back towards real life rather than towards the numinous. It's very bizarre that he does that. I'm glad he does. I don't want too many novels to do that, but I'm glad this one does.
Yeah. Not a lot of novels like this on the Hugo's list.
No, there's not. But it does. Now, this actually did raise a question for me about the issue of breach itself, or the act of breaching. Because there's a part where, this is when everything's going crazy near the climax. There's a point he says, "A noise of a dog in the woods made us look up. The dog was in Beschel. I was ready to unhear, but of course I did not have to. And I'm curious, can animals commit breach?"
Right.
And I was like,
If you lose your dog, is that a breach?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an animals guy at all, but it's like, I'm surprised he actually included that. Cause like, why did he raise that question? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and how did you know that dog was in Beschel?
Yeah. Right? Maybe certain breeds.
And this definitely comes in, right? Where people move differently in the two places. Yeah. And that's where really, really interesting stuff. And I mean, this is jumping all the way to the end where Bowden is trying to escape by having an undefined cadence to his walking, an undefined style to his walking. It's like in Dune, trying to do.
I thought about that too.
Stutter step so that the worms don't get you. Where he's like, I'm not walking like I'm from Beschel. I'm not walking like I'm from Olcoma. It's some combination of the two. And so that keeps both of those sides at bay because they can't capture him without knowing which city he's in.
Yeah.
And knowing if they're allowed to see him. And that was really interesting. And I think his plan was to just walk all the way out to the border of another state, right? Or another
city.
Country.
Yeah. That was my understanding as well. So that was what he wanted to do. And that trades in really, so back to that detective fiction class I took a while ago now, an important element of detective storytelling is liminality, right? Like the detective is the liminal figure. They're the one who, They represent law and order. They can talk to politicians, but they also are usually very friendly to some degree or another with the crime bosses, and they know how to talk to these different societies, and they can, they're the ones who recognize the poor kids on the street, and they know how to use those kids to find things and things like that. And this novel takes that idea to the extreme. But what I found was interesting in that, back to what you were saying, is how the novel resolves. It hinges upon a conflict of liminalities between Bowden and Borloo in that respect. And I thought that was really interesting. That's how he pursued that particular line. And, is his point there that we need to have a society of people where everyone is that liminal. We are all so more aware, or is it a matter that we just need to rely on a few people who can do that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really intriguing how that worked out.
I do want to talk some about the detective fiction aspects of the novel, because that's, it's a good chunk of it is dedicated to that. And there's some parts of it that I really, really like. The whole border crossing scene is great.
Yeah.
Where ultimately Borloo commits his breach.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought that was really, really well written and fascinating. But stuff leading up to that, like about the van, where they're investigating the van, that was straight out of like, I was telling my wife, I'm like, we'd been watching, like, there was a show called Manhunt, that had literally, like, they were looking through CCTV for a particular van trying to find this murder suspect. And so that really strongly reminded me of that. And the whole thing with the pass and leaving it in your car and doing that bit of detective work to go, okay, where was that one stolen? Where was it dropped off? Because it didn't have the pass in it.
Yeah.
Then the next one was stolen from there and then driven someplace else, dropped because it didn't have the pass. And then they found this guy's at his garage and stole it. And I thought that was great.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool seeing detectives being really competent, right? And I think that, I think we as people, we value competency and it's very grounded. Again, apparently this is a trope that's been used before. I mean, I don't know what kind of research, I don't know if Mieville did more research, just reading detective novels and how much of it was talking to actual police about how they do it. I don't know. But either way, that part was always compelling whenever it was happening.
Yeah. Like the book isn't super long on character development, right? It's more about the setting and the detective story. I do like though, I like the relationship between Corwi and,
Borloo,
which is just classic straight stuff that I'm used to seeing, between Miller and whoever David Tennant's character was in Broadchurch, you know, Miller, what's the point of view, you know? And then, you know, with Borloo and Dot,
I like that one a lot.
Was really interesting because he was very gruff, very like, you're in my city, shut up.
Yeah. You know? But never a real jerk, right?
Never a real jerk.
I spent a lot of that section waiting for Dot to either betray Borloo or just become, you know, kind of like the FBI in Die Hard, right? When it's just like, look, I am Detective Man and you will not tell me how to be Detective Man. But no, like he's fundamentally very loyal, very trusting. Whenever he is angry, it's because he's rightfully so. Because his own sense of respect has been, and his self esteem has been affronted by Borloo not playing fair.
Right.
I was like, oh, good on you, sir. Like at the end of the day, like I think he's the one I kind of like the most in terms of just like, I want to buy you a present of some sort because you don't have an arm anymore.
Yeah, that was too bad. Yeah. Getting shot.
But weirdly, I still kind of like the relationship between Borloo and Ashel as well. Weirdly.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things like I don't even know why I liked it because I was reading this. I'm like, you know, on paper, this doesn't really work. Like if you submit this to a creative writing class, the teacher would rip you apart for not, you know, fitting in little bits of characterization and not honoring this, that, and the other. But like, for some reason it works. And like, there's something kind of, I think, honest about Ashel's character that comes across very effectively that makes him just very, I think we are impelled to trust him because he's so just honest with us.
Yeah. It is interesting with Ashel where like he's not letting Borloo just do what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. Right. Where Borloo ends up in breach and he's like, hey, I'm a detective. I would like to detect. And he keeps telling him, look, the only investigation going on here is into your breach.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing. And finally, you know, they kind of warm up to each other a little bit and ultimately work together. And I think that's always compelling.
Yeah, it is. And maybe kind of extending on off of that is maybe Borloo's relationship with himself. I don't know. I found that last page really powerful for some reason. I'm not even certain why, that those last couple of paragraphs where he just like declares himself to be an avatar of breach and how's he put it? Cause it was just, I don't know. I found it very,
where he's kind of saying goodbye to everybody without actually seeing them.
Yeah. We are all philosophers here where I am. And we debate among many other things, the question of where it is that we live. On that issue, I am a liberal. I live in the interstices, yes, but I live in both cities, in both the city and the city. And there's something about that resolve, that sense of like internal peace that he seems to have with that. I found that very moving for some reason.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of moving at the end where you know, he realizes he's never leaving Breach. Yeah. And he's like, I want to say goodbye to a couple people. And Ashel is like, nope, you can't do that. But he still gets his little moment with both Dot and Corwi.
Yeah, he finds his way to do it.
And I thought that was nice.
I agree. That was very touching.
You know, the fact is, Borlu, like, we don't, we have his internal point of view and everything, but there isn't a ton of explanation as to why he cares about the case. And we haven't even talked about the case.
True, actually.
Really, right? And this is why, and I want to talk about the television series. Did you get to watch it, by the way?
No, I tried, and my Blu-ray player is too old. It can't actually run IMDb TV.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah.
Oh, you can do it through the Prime app.
Well, the Prime app said, like, this device does not support this kind of subscription.
Gotcha. Yeah. IMDb TV is incredibly frustrating because you get, like, 9 minutes of your show and then 2 minutes of commercials.
That's awful.
And so it can be a slog, especially for me who I like to watch a lot of my media while I'm exercising. I don't want to be rowing super hard for 2 minutes watching commercials.
That makes a lot of sense.
So, but it was interesting in that the series gives him a little more drive because it introduces an ex-wife character who was also interested in Orsini and was had a relationship with Bowden. And so it drives his character motivation a little more. And I thought that was a good change, but there's a lot of changes that they ended up making.
Oh, interesting.
But I thought it was a decent adaptation.
Good to know. Yeah. I'll have to, maybe just plug my computer into the TV and do it that way. I don't know. I want to watch it. I hear it's in general quite good. Just my own equipment is against me.
I mean, like I said, we haven't really talked much about the actual case, where it's really pretty simple, right? Yeah. Where you had Mahalia, who was, I think, and I want to bounce this off you just because it's something that I read pretty quickly, and I watched the series, and I think it's a little different there. Essentially, she was being a mule, taking because there was an archaeological dig, right? And the fact that you have these two cities that have been either pushed together or partially separated, archaeology would be a really interesting study there, and if it shows artifacts that are from Orsini, then that's really, really interesting, right? Or that lead to that. And so I think, correct me if I'm wrong, she had kind of been duped into thinking these artifacts tell us about Orsini, smuggle them out for us, and that will help us, you know, develop that investigation, when in reality they were just using it for profit.
As far as I understood, yes. The other important thing with that is the factor of Bowden himself, right? So you have this guy who believed in Orsini, wrote about Orsini, wrote his book and everything, gets eviscerated by his scholastic community. And so he himself denounces it, but then eventually he goes back and he starts trying to revive that, but he can't do it himself. He can't directly do it because then he's just the crazy guy again. And so he has to try and create this mythos around it. And so I think that's And so the way that he feeds into it, kind of like he unsees his own sense of reason in the past in order to believe in this delusion as well. So that's another important aspect of it, I think.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good way of putting it about the unseeing and a different kind of directionality to the unseeing and your own past.
Yeah. One thing I kept noticing about this novel, just as a side thing, is how, again, like, you know, Mieville himself has a PhD, and you can tell, like, he kind of dug a little bit into his own past for that. Like, there were so many times that I was like, oh, that's right, Mieville was a PhD student. Like, just whenever they make a comment about like the inane notes that Mahala wrote, right, or you know, like having to sift through things, I was like, oh, I feel you, man. Like, it makes way too much sense. It was as someone writing a dissertation, it made way too much sense to me.
Yeah.
And so they were using her, and then when she starts recognizing that it's not real, is when they kill her.
Right.
But it comes across as kind of like, you know, the real impetus for her death is more so the fact that Bowden is angry that she's not believing, right? It's like, if she doesn't believe in it, then it makes it even harder for him to believe that he isn't inventing things.
Right.
And so his own sense of worth, both maybe as a man and an individual, but also as a scholar, is thoroughly imperiled by her in that respect.
Right. And then it's typical, unfortunately, the real world, women end up hurt.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, men's egos.
Yeah. And I, for that reason, I was actually kind of surprised that both Mahalia and Yolanda both died for that reason alone.
Yeah.
I think I was kind of expecting a bit more.
Yeah, but, kind of fridging the women characters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are killed. I thought fridging is about when they're killed specifically and only in order to forward a male's character. And like, I don't feel like Yolanda's death does that. You could argue that, I think, about Mahalia, but I'm not certain that really applies to Yolanda's death.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
But it is still like, it still kind of seems like it's a bit cringy. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like the women characters are so strong as individuals. Like, no, you're not so much their ability to affect change in the world, but their strength of self is, I think, very powerful and certainly complicates that a bit.
That's actually one cool thing about the adaptation is Dot is a woman in the adaptation.
Oh, cool. That would be cool. Yeah.
And yeah. And so and she's really cool. I really like the actor who plays her.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm down with that. Actually, another thing about Yolanda that was interesting, though, is how she's the foreigner, and yet she's the one who she seems to consider Borlu more of an outsider than she herself is. I just thought, again, back to that issue of liminality, that issue of where the characters fit into the story, but it's like how I do you think that's more so because she feels so pulled into the locus of the conspiracy because she feels like a target, or do you think that's more so because of does she feel that she's on her studies, she knows Olcoma in a certain way that she thinks that maybe she sort of belongs to Olcoma more than Borlu does?
Yeah, that was kind of the impression I got, that he is an outsider in Olcoma.
Yeah. Even though she is also.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. And I also think it's interesting, often with detective fiction, you've got, usually the detective is kind of like has some sort of like secret wound in their soul that they're trying to hide, but usually like in solving, right, in pursuing the case, in Broadchurch, he's got his disgraces and he's trying to redeem himself. But Borlu is already like a completed soul in that respect. Like he talks about how like he's already given up smoking. He's already like changed his life in certain ways to become a perfectly good and decent fellow. And I think that's interesting that he's already, I took him to be very much as complete of a man as he can be until he discovers Breach. And in some ways that kind of completes him more than he thought it could. I thought it was interesting how, because normally the detective story, it's about finding yourself through it. And I guess that does still happen, but it happened in a very different way than I'm used to seeing in detective stories. But yeah, I think that's, I guess kind of the last thing I've got on this. Well, I guess the last thing I want to talk about, or that, just a little note I wanted to add, is page 3. It's right at the very end. Because I made a note to myself at the very beginning of the book. So we have that epigraph from Bruno Schulz's The Cinnamon Shops. It says, "Deep inside the town, there open up, so to speak, double streets, doppelganger streets, mendacious and delusive streets." Which, okay, that works. But I wrote a note to myself. I said, Mieville misses a chance to quote Robert Frost's Mending Wall, which is the poem by Robert Frost that ends with the sentence that fences make good neighbors. It just deals with themes of alienation. And then on page 307, it's the second paragraph of chapter 29. He says, "Oklahoma's government announced a new campaign, vigilant neighbors, neighborliness, referring both to the people next door, what were they doing, and to the connected city. See how important borders are." And I was like, oh, because fences make good neighbors. And just how he does kind of come around to that point about referencing that poem kind of indirectly, but the issue of how we come to venerate our borders for no reason, really. And that's unfortunately more real today than that was when Mieville published the novel, unfortunately.
Yeah, big time. I have to say, it's always nice to have somebody on who has, a different sort of scholarship than I do.
Yeah.
Because, I'm not, I've been a big reader for a lot of my life, but, I don't have a real solid academic background in literature.
Yeah, no, I was glad to bring that here. So looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, anything else that you want to talk about, or we can move to final thoughts?
I guess one other just interesting point about the book as a whole, again, maybe this speaks to the fact that this novel, by being so many, not being so many things, it kind of becomes something to all things, is how, and this is this ties with Ancillary Justice for being the most decorated novel in genre fiction, with 7 major awards each. So this one won the Hugo, obviously, tied with The Wind Up Girl for that, which I haven't read that one yet, but I've heard good things. World Fantasy, Arthur C. Clarke Award, BFSA, Locus, The Kitschies Red Tentacle, and the Kurd Laßwitz Prize, which is some German sci-fi prize. Also nominated for the Nebula and the Campbell Award. And so I just, like, you know, this is a novel that, for all of its strangeness and difficulties trying to pin it down, it's clearly had a huge impact on a sizable community in that respect. I think that's, I don't, normally we tend to think that it goes to the books that seem to embody something. You know, Dune is one of those novels, and it's become like one of the sci-fi novels, or Lord of the Rings. Actually, Lord of the Rings didn't win any prizes, but still. And this is a novel that doesn't seem to have anything, and yet maybe it has everything at the same time. I don't know. But final thoughts, I'm kind of a fan. I know this is very different from other Mieville. Like, he's more known for his more like Lovecraftian type stuffs with his like Perdido Street Station and stuff like that. So I know this one's very different, but I'm excited to read more Mieville in the future.
Okay. I mean, that was something I was going to ask you, is if you had read any of his other stuff, because I haven't.
Yeah.
I saw that he has a novel called King Rat, which is interesting because there's a James Clavell novel by the same name that I've read a number of times.
Oh, interesting.
That's in the Asian
title. Yeah, I know about that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that one.
But you're saying this is very different than his other work.
From what I know, yeah. Like Perdido Street Station, I know is like, I mean, there's the big city thing, but it's like you've got people who are like bug human hybrids and all kinds of just like weird body horror stuffs. And it's like, you know, usually when I think of weird fiction, I think about that kind of thing. And he's very like Lovecraftian and stuff like that. So this is very tame, I guess.
Gotcha.
Now, you've read a lot more Hugo winners than I have. I'm trying to say this or American Gods. I think those are the kind of the two, by a long shot, the two most profane novels in the Hugo list, right?
Oh, probably. Yeah. There is a lot of language in this one. And I mean, that's never been something that bothered me.
It does kind of stand out to me. To me, at least, it's like I'm just not used to Hugo winners having this much swearing.
Trying to think if there was another one that
maybe Ender's
that
I Game
recently that was that way. Yeah, but even that is like it's, juvenile.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. As I say, stuff. It's not as adult in its language in that respect.
I mean, Red Shirts is definitely right up there.
Oh, okay, I haven't read that one yet. So,
yeah, it's like rated R Star Trek.
Okay, you know? It's on my Kindle. I'm actually going down to my sister's house for Thanksgiving this week, and her husband's a big Trekkie, and I know for a fact we're going to be binging season 2 of Lower Decks this weekend as a result.
Nice.
So, yeah. So when I hear rated R, I'm like, I actually have Red Shirts on my Kindle. Maybe that would be my fun read between board games.
It's a quick read. Yeah. And it's like you get through the first part of it really quick and you're like, oh, that story's done. And then it has it's a novel with 3 codas or something like that. I can't remember.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that is the subtitle. You're right. I forgot about that. So yeah, maybe that'll be what I take with me for the weekend. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, cool. Final thoughts. Yeah, I enjoyed this one. I enjoyed the discussion as well. Good. And, you know, it's not going to be in probably the top half of the Hugo winners for me. But definitely one I enjoyed. And
yeah,
I don't know. Sometimes it's nice that for it to have a book that's not too long. I had a string of pretty long ones for a bit there. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I liked it. It's weird. It's different. I'm glad it exists. I'm glad there are not too many like it. It's nice that it stands out.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, before we sign off, where can people find you?
You can find me at, just go to, isu.edu and you can find me in the Idaho State University directory. That's really the best place to find me.
Okay. Okay. Not much social media presence outside that.
Not too much. No, I probably should get on Twitter one of these days so I can start following other scholars, but I'm scared to do it.
Sounds good. Well, Paul, it was great having you. Thank you so much for coming on, and I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Paul about an interesting book. Thank you so much for listening. I'm recording this on Thanksgiving weekend in the US, and I just wanted to say I'm very thankful for all the listeners to this podcast and for all the guests, especially because without them, I wouldn't have a podcast. I never intended to do a solo thing here. So I'm grateful for everybody who's ever reached out to either guest or to just say hello or send me feedback. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.